Welcome to Cashflow Positive. I'm your host, Kenny Bedwell, founder of SCR Insights, one of the leading data platforms in the industry. Through using data and analytics, I've been able to replace my W-2 with cash flow from my successful short-term rentals. And my goal is to help you achieve the same freedom and success. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just a novice looking to make your mark, Cashflow Positive is your go-to resource for unlocking the full potential of your property portfolio.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Cashflow Positive. And today we're talking about the part two side of finding high ROI SCR deals with no money down. I probably should say little money down, but practically no money, because you know, $30,000-$50,000 is almost no money to those who are investing in short-term rentals. So little to no money down, how to do it. And we're going to dive into the strategies, the breakdown of the financing piece, where to go for financing, how to find contractors, all this good stuff. And I have brought in one of the best property finders in the entire country. And no, it's not me. It's actually one of my consultants. She is the top dog at SCR Insights in finding properties, really good at negotiating, and I'm super excited to have her on here. She is from Nolens, just in New Orleans. She's been investing in real estate probably since the Great Recession, right, of 08 or before that. Maybe. Yeah, I think so. But she's got SCR, she's got LTR, she's almost got everything. And like I said, she is one of the best consultants to work with. Without further ado, Rachel, tell us more about yourself.
I am a longtime, lifelong resident of New Orleans, Louisiana. Been a real estate investor full-time for longer than I care to admit, because it shows my age a little bit. But I started my real estate journey in flipping, and then moved to building some spec homes, and then eventually found my way into short-term rental investing when I wanted to buy and hold around the time that I turned 40 in the middle of COVID. So, but I've made most of my money and built my knowledge through buying rehab properties and fix and flip properties.
Okay, awesome. How many short-term rentals do you have right now?
Four.
And where are they located?
Tennessee, Mississippi, Louisiana.
All right, that's awesome. And then where are your long-term rentals? Just all in New Orleans?
New Orleans. Yeah, correct.
Okay. All right. Cool. Well, that's awesome. So you got a diverse portfolio. Any MTRs?
No. Never got into it. Never. Maybe I'm not in the right market for it. I mean, I think that a short-term rental, especially in an urban market, can easily be run like a midterm rental. Just depends on the seasonality of your particular market and what the need is. But no, nothing that's specific to MTR.
And frankly, I don't know, this is me personally, but I don't get the, if you're going to go after an MTR, you might as well just go after a short-term rental.
I would 100% agree with that. I think you have more flexibility.
Right. I don't get it. I understand why there are MTRs and who stays at them. But it typically ends up being people who took a house that was in maybe a more suburban area or urban and flipped it from an STR or maybe long-term to an MTR or STR down to MTR. But it's never like I'm actively seeking out MTRs. And I probably just offended somebody, but whatever.
No, I agree. I think that the MTR thing, I think for a second, got a little bit more press than it should have because people felt like they were maybe struggling with their short-term rentals. And as I'm sure you know, when people feel like they don't have the answer, they go looking for answers elsewhere. And there were people promoting, MTRs might be a good fit. Really, it's probably what's going on with your short-term rental. But I don't see it as a separate asset class. I think you have short-term rentals. I think you have long-term rentals. I don't really feel like there's an in-between. I think short-term rentals can do both.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Cool. All right. And for those of you listening, if I haven't, given away too much in the intro, Rachel is one of the consultants at SCR Insights, and she's really, really, really good at finding deals. But we're not going to talk about finding deals. We're going to be focusing more on how to find high ROI deals with little to no money. I probably should have put little to no money. She was getting on to me about that earlier in the title. I was like, no, people won't click on it if it's with somebody. It's like, no money. And how do we do that? What does that look like? So there's a lot to unpack here, a lot to dive into. So first off, let's just start. How the heck does somebody buy a property with virtually no money into it and expect it to be a high return?
Well, the easiest answer to that would be, if you have no money of your own to start off with, hit up a family member or a friend, get a collective group of friends together, everybody pile in and kind of, you know, pull your money together to get started. But you're going to need to use some version of what I'm going to call it creative financing, but not creative financing in the way that we've all heard about. They have lenders in the real estate world, in all, across all asset classes, that they specialize in helping people come in with lower down payments, and then force equity into properties and then refinance the same property so that they can get the lender's original cash out and put it on a permanent loan and then get the investor, your money, back at the end of that process. So, it, you know, everybody has heard of BRRRR, but really BRRRR, I think, is finally starting to make the rounds in the short-term rental community, but it's been around for real estate investors for a very, very long time, especially in the long-term rental side. A lot of long-term rental hosts, people that went into that asset class, they're not getting the returns that short-term rental people are. So they're not willing to leave $50,000 of their own money in every long-term rental that gives them $200 a month. It just doesn't make any sense. So they've been using this BRRRR strategy for a long time. It's very similar to what I do. You know, again, I started as a flipper, but you're looking to... obviously, you have to start somewhere. Ideally, you can find a little bit of money, pull a little bit of money together, whether it's through family, friends, tap something. But you're going after low value homes or low purchase price homes that are maybe distressed. And there's some room for improvement. And you're looking at that market and the comps available to see if can I force some equity. And forcing equity doesn't always have to be a giant project. It doesn't have to be reconfiguring a 3-bedroom to a 5-bedroom. It doesn't have to be adding a bathroom. Sometimes there's a house that's sitting out there that just looks like the previous owner died in it and it hasn't been touched in 40 years. And just ripping down some wallpaper and running through with a coat of paint and new floors and updating the kitchen and the bathrooms and the light fixtures, and you can force $50,000 worth of equity. It looks different in every market, but those deals are all over the place. And there are a lot of popular short-term rental destination markets where you have a lot of properties that are semi-distressed and need work. I think, you know, for me, again, when I started, that's all I knew. So I went to Tennessee and I bought a fixer-upper and I forced a bunch of equity into it and then operated as a short-term rental. And your cash on cash just goes through the roof when you have a small amount in and then you're able to refinance on the backside and get a bunch of that money back out. Because you're leaving very little money in the deal. In most of my deals, I have less than $50,000 in them, some of them less than 30.
Wow. And what type of returns are you seeing?
Well, like the case study, I would say that the Mississippi house, I mean, I all in my total loan value on that is right around 300,000, but my cash that was left in the deal was under 30, and that property grosses 85 to 90K a year.
Wow. Wow. Yeah.
So my cash on cash looks, you know, makes me look like I'm the smartest person in the room. Really not. It's just the strategy that was used to acquire the property and then being the person that's willing to go after those deals and put in the work. Not everybody wants to deal with contractors, wants to deal with homes that don't look perfect. But if you, the same way that I think people have a vision for buying a basic house and turning it into a super property, if you can have that vision and apply it to a home that's maybe slightly dated or, you know, a little less exciting, if you can take that vision from the get-go and take that house from being under average to above average, you've created that split, you've created that equity gap, and you are the beneficiary of that. Because even if you don't refinance, I've had some that I bought and put my own cash into the renovations and I didn't do a refinance at the end of it. It just depends on the deal, but it puts you in a very good position because you're typically buying for less than your competitors are going to be buying. So your cost basis is lower. And then you've got this equity spread. So maybe I don't want to run it 2 years down the road. I can sell, but I'm looking at a nice profit then, or I want to refinance it on the backside and I can get some of my money back out and I can then reuse that cash to do another project. That's the benefit of it and the power of it for people trying to scale from very little.
Okay. So You used the term at the beginning, and we got to define it for those who are unfamiliar with it. You said burring. I like to call it stirring for short-term rentals, but whatever. So what is burring? Tell us about the definition of burring.
Yeah, it's you're going to buy a property, you're going to rehab it, you're going to rent it out, and you're going to refinance it. You know, you can argue the semantics of in what order you do those things, but it works the same way with a short-term rental. I'm going to go look to target a property that needs some work, whether that's a big, giant, full-blown renovation where I think I'm going to convert garage to extra living space to force equity that way and grow my square footage. Maybe I'm going to add a bathroom. Or maybe it's just like I said, it's dated. You're looking for that thing that's priced under the value of the average in the market. And then by the same way we run our numbers with short-term rentals, and you sit there and you think about how much am I going to put into this property, we're going to have to just get it up to the level of the rest of the neighborhood, hopefully a little bit nicer. In that way, we're going to create some equity. Then we're going to go back to the bank and say, okay, I bought it for X and I put Y into it. Now it's worth Z. I would like to refinance, pay off my first loan that I took with you, which you should have only used maybe 10 or 15% down on the purchase price, right? So I gave the bank 10 to 15% of the original purchase price of my money to purchase the asset. The bank loaned me the rest of the purchase price amount, and then they loaned me the money to renovate. So I'm not going back into my pocket for that. At the end of it, if I've done it correctly and I've forced enough value into the property, I can then, the same bank will go, okay, now we'll refinance that, the two loans, because I have my purchase loan and I had my renovation funds as two separate streams of loan. I'm going to turn that into one permanent end loan on whatever terms I set and refinance out. If you're really, really lucky, you'll get everything back, including the money that you used as your portion of the down payment. That's not to say that it still doesn't provide you this amazing cash on cash return, because even if I can't get quite all of my down payment money back, what I can generally do is I can finance into my renovation portion, my furniture, my hot tub, some other little things like that to set it up as a short-term rental. So maybe I had to leave my 15% down payment on the purchase price in it, but I could also create enough of a gap for myself that I can buy the furniture, I can buy the hot tub, I can maybe do some of the design with the bank's money, and then I refinance on the backside of an end loan, put it on permanent financing, and then I launch as a short-term rental.
Yeah. So let's unpack that a little bit, because I think that's kind of it. You know what I mean? Like the whole no money, like obviously, look, you're going to need to have some money to invest into a property, but $30,000, even $50,000, for a lot of us who are trying to buy short-term rentals, we have that at least, right? Like, if you don't have that, then it's probably not time for you to go buy a property. Like, there's no bank that's going to be like, oh, you have zero, unless you're doing creative financing, you know, sub two, Pace Morby stuff, like Uber creative financing is what I want to call it. But no money, $30,000, $50,000 for sure. And you can also, I know, Rachel, we talked about this before at one point, you know, using credit cards like 0% APR interest rates for a full year to pay for furnishings, to pay for things, and let the property pay that debt off. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I absolutely. So again, when I started, I had a ton of experience with real estate, but I was hell bent on kind of creating the short-term rental portfolio to be standalone so that I wasn't taking money out of my flipping business or the spec building side of things. I wanted to create something from essentially nothing. And I used every one of those available tools. I mean, I think people are ignorant to the fact that there are so many resources out there. All of the places that you think of that you buy materials from, down to the Wayfairs of the world, they have private label credit. Most of them offer that at 0% interest for 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 24 months. So it literally costs you nothing to borrow the money. It doesn't get any better than free money, right? Like if I can use somebody else's money to make money, I'm going to do that every day over spending my own money. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can Google, but the well-known versions are Home Depot, Lowe's, the Floor and Decor, Lumber. If you can think of a place that sells building materials to consumers, they probably have private label credit accounts that are very easy to get. You don't have to have an 800 credit score. You don't have to have previous experience in any of this. It's just credit and it's easy to come by. And all of them that I know of have 0% interest periods for their cardholders. So I reuse mine all the time. I mean, I'll buy the project stuff and then I'll turn around and I'll pay it off and then I'll use it again. But I'm never paying interest because I'm just keeping track of, oh, okay, I got 6 months to pay these people. I got 12 months to pay these people before it costs me anything to borrow that. It stretches the budget further and puts you going into your pocket for less cash, which in this strategy is the ultimate goal. It's to preserve as much of your liquid capital as humanly possible and leverage as much as you can. The part of the leverage is obviously going in and buying something that needs a lift or some work done. You're leveraging yourself and your ability or desire to go in and do some of the work that others won't do because not everybody wants a project. But if you're the person that maybe has limited funds, a project is where you should start. And believe me, you will learn so much and it will stop as you get further along in the journey. If you have to start this way, number one, you're going to be making, I feel like, better decisions from the get-go because you do have a finite amount of cash. You can't lose. You can't make bad choices early on because it'll really set you back. So I find those investors to be a lot more quote unquote savvy because they have everything riding on the choices that they make, the markets they go into, the properties that they choose. It helps build a very solid foundation of the fundamental understanding of just investing in real estate. It makes you very good at it. And then the unintended consequence, I think, is that it teaches people to not be afraid. I mean, I work with clients all the time who are very scared of little things that come up on inspection reports because they just have no understanding of construction. Once you've been there and seen it a couple of times, you just get that much more familiar and confident, like, oh, that's not a big deal. Or this is something structural and I should definitely be worried about it. But it's a great place that forces you to educate yourself, really get knowledgeable. And the bonus is you are able to leverage what we all have, which is our own like sweat equity, essentially. If you're willing to put in the work, you can come in with a lot less cash than a lot of other people. And bonus, you've generally bought for less than your neighbor has. So when times get tough, you know, you're in a better position. Your starting cost basis is a lot lower than a lot of other people in your market, which it lends itself very well to short-term rentals.
Right, right. You know, and that allows you to, whenever there's adjustments in revenue, because we know that revenue just doesn't climb year over year forever, right? There's ups and downs, there's waves and troughs. So whenever revenue goes down, you're not, you know, your margins aren't narrowed thin where it impacts you as much as somebody else who bought at the peak of the market, you know? So definitely love that. But this begs the question though, you know, what lenders are going to lend on something like this?
There's a handful, I would say. I mean, I think everybody by now has heard of Brenna Carls and the Mortgage Shop. I know that they have a product that is specific to the Burr style investor lender. Yeah, but there's
Brenna and a lot of these independent, you know, no national banks are really going to get super involved in this, but what types of loans do they offer?
So they, most of the time they call them a fix and flip loan. What you're looking for is a fix and flip loan or a construction to perm financing, but not for new construction, for an existing project. Every lender is going to call it something, you know, one of those two things, right? It's a fix and flip loan or it's a Burr loan or it's a construction to perm loan, but they're all generally the same. The lender will dictate how much you have to put down. And again, the down payment you come up with is on the actual purchase price of the property, not the finished value. So if you're looking at buying a property for $150,000 and the lender wants 15%, you're putting 15% down on the 150. That's what you have to come in for. As you gain more experience, the first time starting investor, if this is your first project, you would be in a good position if you can find a lender that'll loan more than 75% of the overall cost of the renovation. So again, it's almost two loans in one. They're going to give you the 85% of the purchase price that you need after you come in for your down payment. But then we got to renovate the house and that costs money, right? So the lender will also come in for that for you. The more experience you have, the more they will cover up to 100%. So there are plenty of lenders that will lend 100% of your cost to renovate and 85% of your purchase price. And that'll all come out of the same lender, same loan process. And then when it's done, they'll merge the two loans together and pay that off with one loan, one permanent loan. You're looking for investor-friendly BRRRR or fix and flip lenders. And there are a ton of them.
Yeah. It's actually relatively common. And here's something crazy too, guys. After talking, this is really, when you get into this world, this type of financing and these loans, like, it is all about relationships, you know, like getting experience and the lenders trusting you and the relationships you have. We've built, SCR Insights has built relationships with lenders, and especially with these types of things where they're trying to build products just for our clients, where they're saying, well, if you help them, we will give your clients better terms. If we know you guys are working with them. And because, I mean, if you're listening to Rachel and you're like, wow, she sounds really she is very knowledgeable, if you haven't put that together yet. But like working with her gives you that, like, can help you too. And so whether you're working with us or you're working with a mentor or somebody who has fix and flip experience. Oh, got that mixed up. Say that 10 times over and over. Flip and fix experience. And working with a bank that you have a relationship with, you can get better terms. And so it's not just kind of like your traditional Fannie Mae loan products. And it's really cool. I don't know, Rachel, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, I have a client right now who is under contract, actually going to view his property right now for the first time. But he has done several of these fix and flip products or projects in his home state and wanted to take that knowledge and move it over to the short-term rental side of things. And I introduced him to a lender that I've worked with that I know several other people in the space have worked personally with this lender. And, you know, he called me up ecstatic because they're going to cover 100% of his renovation costs because he's got a couple of projects under his belt and he can prove that he has a little bit of experience. So it's his first time working with this lender. So he has no pre-existing relationship whatsoever, but he's already established a little bit of a track record. And then we've referred quite a few people to this particular lender. So yeah, there's strength in building a lender relationship. And I think, you know, if I was starting over again, that's something I personally didn't do early enough in my career because I didn't have confidence in myself. I didn't think the banks really wanted to work with me. I was a young kid with little experience and little money in my pocket and just had this idea that I could go out and do this. It took me years before I actually got a lender, a banker who's local to me that helped me with all of my projects. When I did, the doors kind of opened, you know, once I realized that that was such a key component of things. Yeah, I would say absolutely. It's the lender can be the make or break piece of your project. And if you get a good one who is just as interested in you succeeding as they are in just getting your business, you're going to be very successful.
That's really good advice. I love that. What is the downside though? Like, is there any, I mean, this sounds sweet. Like basically going in, buying these deals, no money in. Yes, you do have to do some sort of renovations, but what's the risk in doing a BRRRR or STIR? We're going to call it STIR. So what's the risk in doing STIRs these days?
I mean, well, first and foremost, I would say that there's always a risk associated with you have to still buy correctly. You have to buy the right thing. You have to be sure on your valuations on the back end. And that sounds very scary, but it's not that difficult. A good agent in any market, if you hand them a property and say, I'm thinking about buying this, they want this much money for it. If it was really nice in an excellent condition, can you go pull me some market comps and tell me what the market comps are selling for in my little pocket of the world? A good agent is a great starting place because they'll give you some of their own ARV after repair value valuations for you to just have a starting point. But there's then the risk of, you know, how to find the contractors, how to control your budget and your costs. You have to have a budget just like anything else. So you've got to create a budget and it's just a math equation. If I bought it for this much and it's going to be worth this much at the end, and I have to do these things in the middle, then I've got to work within the confines, the bumpers on either side of my equation so that I don't go over budget and end up with money that's a sunk cost, stuck in the property that I cannot get back out of it when I go to refi. There is risk. I would say it's riskier to do it with for a while, you know, as influencers go, right? HGTV got very popular for a while and flipper shows were all over the place and they were all the rage. And a million people thought that they could run out and flip a house. Yes, anybody can go buy a house and make it look nicer than it did the day that they purchased it. That's the easy part, right? The hard part is understanding the market, understanding what you're buying into and the nuances of the market and why certain properties, you know, if you buy across this kind of imaginary line in a neighborhood, those homes are valued way lower than the homes on the other side of the imaginary line. So I think that the biggest risk is not actually acquiring and doing the work and doing the refinance. It's really understanding the market. That's where I see people make the biggest mistake. But again, these are the fundamentals of real estate investing. And I would say that that is literally the same thing that people mess up with in short-term rentals, right? Where do they make the largest mistake? They pick the wrong market. They pick the wrong thing in the right market. Same thing applies. If you understand those tenets of investing, that's definitely the pitfall with this as well, because you have to understand where you're buying and what kind of value you can actually force without going overboard and going over your budget.
That's a really good point. One thing I want to circle back to that you said is finding the right real estate agent. Do short-term rental agents who are really good at selling short-term rental properties, do they all know how to find these like undervalued fix and flip deals and know how to, you know, identify those?
I would say that some of the better ones, you have some that are seasoned real estate investors themselves that could be useful. But the ones that are focused solely on short-term rentals and have only really stayed in that sandbox, I would say no. I would say go find an investor-friendly real estate agent that understands either flipping or burring. And there are a ton of them out there.
How do you do that? So let's talk about that. Because I kind of set up there. I lobbed a softball question because I knew the answer to that one. But it has to be said, like, this isn't if you're going to do this strategy, you can't just call up, you know, the first STR agent that, you know, is, you know, the influencers we all know on social media and expect them to present you fix and flip deals that make sense, because a lot of them don't have experience with that. Some of them do, but most of them actually don't. So how do you find agents who have this experience in these markets and maybe they're not already influencers in our space?
Honestly, the first place that I would start is Bigger Pockets. Their website is amazingly resourceful. I mean, our little asset class of short-term rentals is very small compared to other asset classes and other kind of genres of real estate investing. There's a whole world out there that most people, if they came into it from the short-term rental side, they're just not familiar with. But Bigger Pockets is a nationally recognized, very, very it's the best resource, I think, that's out there. There are blogs, there's a tab right on their page. Like, are you looking for a realtor? And then tell us what kind of there are realtors that specialize in just this all over the country. And if you can connect with one or two good ones and you decide you want to pivot into a different market, they will, just like in our industry, they'll know somebody. They're going to know their counterpart in St. Louis, Missouri, if you're working with the guy in Memphis, Tennessee, right? That there's another network of people that we don't often get introduced to that is out here and very vast and large. But I would say my starting place would be, I'm trying to think of how I did it at the beginning, but Bigger Pockets is now out there and a huge resource. That's where I would go. Otherwise, you're interviewing real estate agents and having to spend a lot of time asking them questions about, do they understand this method? Do they understand what they're looking for in a property that allows you to force some equity into it? And do they know how to find those? In another, on the other side of things, and maybe not for the very first one, your first one you should probably just find with a realtor off the MLS. But in every town across America, there are people wholesaling properties. And wholesale deals are off-market properties that have generally been negotiated ahead of time by the wholesaler, the guy in the middle. So somebody who makes it their entire life's mission to go around and cold call people and see if they'll sell a distressed property to them. They pre-negotiate the sales price with the seller. And for that effort and finding the properties and the deals, they stick a little, you know, a cut on top, if you will. Those are still generally better deals than anything that's just kind of sitting on the MLS. However, not all wholesale deals are good, because not all wholesalers are good. And a lot of them will try and convince you that things are worth more than they actually are. And then, you know, I buy plenty off of the MLS. Just because it's listed on the MLS for, say, $300,000 doesn't mean that you can't walk in there and say, man, this thing's a dump, and I see it's been sitting here for 178 days, I'll give you 220 and they wouldn't look at it. But yeah, I would say start with bigger pockets. They have a Facebook page as well. Start there, talk to other investors in the space who have done something like that. Ask them for a referral, and then, you know, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon your way across the country so that you can find a realtor with that knowledge in the town that you're looking for.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, cool. So let's move to contractors. So I think that's a big hurdle for most people, especially who don't have any experience with any construction. And frankly, we've all had bad experience with contractors at some point in time. So what kind of advice or recommendations do you give with sourcing, finding, working with contractors, especially if you don't live nearby?
Number one, I would say if you can get at least one contractor reference from the agent that helped you find the property, that's a good solid starting place. Generally speaking, again, agents make it their business to have a pretty extensive network the same way that we do. We're stronger with the network of people that we have so that you can help your clients better. So I would try and get one referral out of my real estate agent. I would try and find, make friends with, stalk somebody on Facebook, somebody else that has flipped or rehabbed a house in the market that you're going into, and reach out to them, find out who they use. Past that, check, you know, the Facebook groups that are specific to whatever area it is that you're looking at, or again, go to Bigger Pockets and try and find that page for that town's investors and get some kind of a referral or a starting place. If you can't get a single referral, you know, the phone books really aren't around anymore, but go to Google. And you're going to have to call people and you're going to have to talk to them. Never hire a contractor who wants a dollar from you up front. If they run a legitimate business, they don't need your money to put their crews on site. That's, you know, like pitfall number one. I see people still to this day, every day, I paid my contractor $10,000 up front to come do my deck. Why? Why? That's insane. If they say they need it for materials, you provide the materials. I'll buy the materials for you, good sir. I will have them delivered to the job site. You bring the labor. But when you're vetting your contractors, if you can't find a referral to start with, and I guess I should back up and say, don't ever do a job without getting three quotes. Get three quotes. Even if you know you're going to hire the first guy, still get three quotes. Just keep them honest. Know what you're looking at. Have a reference point to be able to measure what it is that they're presenting that they're going to do for you relative to what you want done. So get three quotes on every piece of the job. The other thing I tell people is, I don't particularly care to hire a GC to oversee the entire job because you're paying more. You're paying a markup. The general contractor, he's going out and subbing all of the pieces of your job to these individual subcontractors that do the actual tasks. And then he's charging you a markup to quote unquote run your job. So if you don't have a massive, like we're not moving walls or building, you know, two new bathrooms, I would never hire a general contractor. I would go find the pros themselves that are in those trades and go straight to them. Again, I'd get three quotes, but those people, this is all they do. You know, I don't want the general contractor who I think that guy's really, really, that guy or gal is really good at their job. They seem trustworthy, but at the end of the day, their bottom line is dependent on them hiring the cheapest laborers on the backside. They're just going to quote unquote be held accountable to you. So I don't feel like you get the same quality control either. And I think where people really make mistakes with contractors is that they're like, oh, well, he's a contractor. So he's got, oh, he's still bidding the job on the back end and he's going to pick the cheap guy because that means he makes more money off of your job. Versus if I cut him out and I go straight to my own drywall contractors, I can go get the best, the rock star drywall guy in my town. I can go get the rock star tile installer in my town and still pay less for that piece of the job than if I had used a GC and know that I got the best. So my advice there is start simple, start with the people that you've already had contact with, get some referrals from them. From there, vetting those referrals still, just because I recommend somebody doesn't mean that you shouldn't go check. Always, always, always talk to them. Don't just take your friend's word for it that they used a great guy. Get with the individual sub or the general contractor. You want to see proof of work that they've done. You also want to ask them very specifically how long it takes them to complete their jobs. And you want to get a contract that says, we have timelines, we have deadlines, how things are going to be handled, who's providing what materials, what the expectations are for you as the owner who's hiring the job out, what's the pay schedule like? Because more and more problems come with contractors because people go into it like you're in a friendship with this person, that you're not in business with them. They don't treat it like they're running a business. You're the boss. You're hiring these people. There need to be clear guidelines, clear expectations, clearly determine how much the job is going to cost and when and what phase people will get paid. But three quotes, vet your own people, and do consider maybe cutting out the general contractor altogether if your job consists of something that seems very manageable, where you can go straight to the individual subs because you get better quality control that way.
That's a really good point. Okay, cool. Well, I think that's extremely helpful. And I know people, it's just one of the things that a lot of people struggle with is the idea of, I got to go deal with contractors and, you know, they're unreliable and just like the different things of why they fail. And so it's good to have a process in place like that and follow those steps. One of the last things I want to circle back to, and I think you do a really good job. I've seen you do this with a lot of clients, and it needs to be talked about. And I think it ties directly in. It doesn't necessarily have to be with BRRRRs. It's about just acquisitions in general and how to get good deals is the negotiations and what you're offering and how you approach the offering. And so when you are looking at a property that you like, whether it's going to be a fixer-upper or whether it's a turnkey, ready to go, you know, whatever property, how do you approach putting in an offer? You know, if you already know the revenue, you've already got your pro forma, but like, how do you approach going in with an offer to negotiate? Because I've seen you lowball people. I've seen you give people asking like all these different things to make the deals work, just depending on the property. So what's your approach? How do you do it? What recommendations do you get?
I think, first and foremost, I definitely, one of the things that I look at, obviously, is time on market. So the longer something's been on the market, the more room I know we have to negotiate, despite what the realtor, you know, I'm good friends with a lot of really amazing real estate agents, but they want to sell a home. And so a lot of times they'll try and discourage you from lowballing. If a home's been sitting out there for quite some time, it's got terrible photos, it's not moving around, I'm definitely going to lowball. What do I lose? I'm going to insult possibly the seller. Oh, that's okay. I'm not their friend either. I plan to have no relationship with them other than buying this home, and we all go our separate ways. So if a property definitely if it needs work, if it's especially if it's got plenty of time on the market, I'm going to lowball. And the other thing, I think that's just a mindset, is stick to your guns. If you believe that a property is overpriced by $100,000 and you go in with a lowball offer, if they counter you back, you know, at 75% of the difference, go back to them again with the same offer. It's a mindset. I literally just had this happen with a client who's under contract in Montana, and I wish I could like actually shout him out by name because he's one of my heroes, but we did this exact same thing. We took an $800,000 house and we offered $100,000 less than asking, and we still intended to get money for repairs, and they came back with some ridiculous counter. And we just said, we're not afraid to walk away. We waited a week and gave them the exact same offer, and they took it. And the real estate agent called me and said, I can't believe that they took that offer. Why not? Their house needs work. It's been on the market for like 175 days. We're going into winter in Montana. Nobody wants to go buy this house. It's going to be freaking cold there any minute now. It takes a special kind. So I think educating yourself, going back to your original question, I like to be in that position of knowledge and strength when I go into a negotiation. I want to know everything about the history of the home. When did these people buy it? I don't care what they paid for it. But if I see that they might have overpaid recently and they're turning around and selling it, that actually tells me not that there's not room. Maybe they're desperate. Maybe they need to get out. Like, I'm picking up context clues from the history of the property. You're also looking at the overall state of their market. You know, if you go into some of these markets right now, there's more inventory than we've seen in like 2.5 years. I've seen those statistics. You're calling them up and telling them it's your lucky day, buddy. You got the golden ticket. Your house is getting an offer. There's 1,000 other houses like yours sitting on the market, and you got the call. You have that leverage and that power over people. And I think that it doesn't get exploited enough. And maybe we're all conditioned because during COVID, the buyers had zero leverage. And that was very true. I mean, they didn't have any leverage. That's not the case today. We're in a very different market environment. But I think people get a very emotional when they go into these deals, and they get kind of attached, and they get afraid that they might lose it. What's the worst that's going to happen? You don't get the deal? Let me tell you, there's another deal tomorrow. There's always another house. That has always been my motto. There's always another house. If I didn't get something, it's because it wasn't meant to be. There's always another one behind it.
And I think too, going back to what you said with the agents, I see a lot of them, the agents are just like, well, you know, there's comps that support the price they're asking, and they just want you to offer that so you can get the deal and get under contract. And I mean, look, I love working. I'm friends with a lot of good agents, but you have to keep in mind they're motivated by the sale, the commissions, right? They're getting commissions. And so although they want to do what's best for the client, they're also like in the back of their minds, they're also trying to get the best price so they can make the most money. And, you know, they might tell you to drop it a little bit, but you could drop it even more. So I see a lot of people struggle with that. Like, well, the agent said to do this, what should I do? And I'm like, stick to your guns. Try what, like you said, what's the worst they're going to say? No. You know, honestly, the worst thing a seller could say is nothing at all. They don't respond to your offer. Because then you really don't know, you know, like if they say no, there's probably going to be a counter, you know, and then you're working, right? Then you've got somewhere to go. So,
well, and I think to add to that too, I mean, it's not just about getting a discount off the property, and you've seen this too. You get a client that the perfect house, you know that that's the winner. You know, it's a winner. The second it hits your screen, you're like, wow, this is a really, really good one. If it's just newly on the market, I'm going to probably go in at full price or very close to full price right away. But in that scenario, I want to be the person that strikes first. So speed and execution is just as important as sticking to your guns when you're trying to beat somebody up for a $100,000 concession on something. If you know it's a deal, and I think that that's something that you taught me, what we do well, if the buyer knows what a deal looks like, then they should be ready to act the second that it hits their desk. Like, man, this is the good one. I'm going in. And those hot properties where maybe you think you're going to have some competition, I'm a huge fan of escalation clauses. I never want to show my hand. We don't want to tell the other side how far we're willing to go, because I don't, you know, I might have gotten bad intel. I might have. The agent for the seller will always try and kind of hype their properties. Oh, we're getting lots of interest. We're expecting multiple offers. So you go in $30,000 above the asking price, and then they never got another offer, and you're the dum-dum that just paid $30,000 too much. Put an escalation clause in place. Start at whatever your number is and go up to the number that you're comfortable with, but that's only going to kick in for a little bit of money, you know. I think it's $1,000.
Appraisal clause in their contingency as well. We just did that one. We had one in the Poconos where we put a contingency. It was like it was listed for 515 or 520. And we put an escalation clause up to 545. But it was contingent upon an appraising. So the guy got it under contract for 535. So he got it. It escalated up to 535. So that's what he got under for. But the appraisal came in at 515. Guess what he got the property for? 515. So it came right back down what they were asking. So there's ways to, you know, do these things where, you know, it works out. But the thing is, you have to put away your pride when you're doing this stuff. You know, I think Rachel, we had some clients who they were like, I just got to get seller credits, you know, with any property you're looking at. And you're like, it doesn't work like that. It's property specific. And if it's a hot property that makes sense and they just listed it, you don't have any leverage. You don't have any like power to come in and demand for all this much lower and expect that you're going to get it. You know, you have to be aggressive. And like you said, striking first and giving them a deadline. Like, I'm going to give you asking what you're asking for, but you have 12 hours to respond to it. You know, and like, just because that we're giving you what you're asking for, you know, that's a win for them. But it all comes back to the numbers. If the numbers make sense, then who freaking cares? You know, we see this with negotiating too. Like, somebody's like dead set on getting $50,000 off the asking price. And then there's like this like standstill where they've negotiated down and it's like a $10,000 difference. And it's a deal that's over $1 million. You're like, it's $10,000 in a loan. Like, that's like, I don't know, 10 bucks a month more or something like crazy. Like, it's nothing. Like, just suck it up, accept it from the seller, because the numbers still make sense. You're still winning. You know, don't walk away from the deal because you didn't get your exact $50,000 number that you were looking for. You know, you got 45 instead. It's like, come on, you know? So I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, but I think you have to put it back on people. And I think that any, you know, the people listening, if you're wanting to become a better investor, you have to look at every angle of every situation. I absolutely do like to come at offers, and we know we're going to make an offer on something. I want to be in a position of strength. I want to have done my research, know as many variables that I can know up front, and go in what I think is going to put me in the best position to win. And I'll work out the details later, because just because I had to go in and pay asking price for something doesn't mean I might not get some credits. I'm going to beat you up on the inspection report when we get it. And I'm going to go back for the money that I hoped that I had gotten on the front end. There's always a way, but being in a position of strength. But on the other side, don't walk away from a good deal over a minuscule amount of money that in the grand scheme of things, you're going to lose more in the opportunity that was lost from maybe buying that house with rate appreciation, buying that house with good cash flow, saving yourself money on your taxes. That you're losing 3-4 ways over some finite amount of money. That's silly. And that's, again, it's just a fundamental real estate investing tactic. Think whole big picture. You can approach everything that you do in this business. And that's why I've always said, like, I love being in short-term rentals, but I like that I came at it from being an investor first before I got to this, because you have so much more knowledge at your disposal that just makes you better and able to execute better, faster, get to that point.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Rachel. Thanks for all the wisdom and advice you give. Rachel, obviously you work with SCR Insights and you help people find deals and you help people do the strategies and implement the strategy you just talked about. So if somebody's like, man, Rachel is awesome, sounds awesome, knows what she's doing, and I really want to work with her, how do they get in touch with you? What's the best way to do it?
You can email me. I think Kenny's going to link my rachel.gignotti. I don't expect anyone to know how to spell my last name at scrinsights.com. I'm also on Facebook under the same first and last name, easy to find. Other than that, I'm an old person who's not into technology, so I don't have all the socials, but,
yeah,
get a hold of me.
Gignotti. So how did, so Rachel, obviously it's rachel.gignotti, G-N-I-A-D-Y at scrinsights.com. Guys, you can work with Rachel. You can. She is usually available, obviously in high demand, but she is one of our best and you can work with her. All you got to do is reach out to her, but she's going to send you to us. So skip that and just come to us and we will set up a call with you and tell you how we can help you find your next great deal. So Rachel, thank you so much for being on the show. Last question for you. All guests get it. I know you listen to the podcast too, which is awesome. But what is one way, it could be about what we talked about or anything else, one way you can help people or any recommendations to help people cash flow positive with their short-term rentals?
Buy better.
Buy better. All right.
Yeah. Buy better. No, yeah. The cash flow, I mean, I think there's better people in that can talk about design and amenities and all the ways to do the guest experience better. But if you buy correctly on the front end, you will never, never not be cash flow positive. That's the secret. That's it.
The mic drop. I love it.
That's it.
That's great. Great. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. And guys, if you enjoyed this episode, please either share it with a friend, or if you haven't left a review yet, we love 5-star reviews. So leave a review. And if you're watching this on YouTube, please hit that subscribe and like button and get notified for the next episode of Cashflow Positive. My name is Kenny Bedwell, and I will see you next week.